Over a third of your professional competence, your literal ability to execute your job effectively in any modern environment has, well, absolutely nothing to do with your technical skills.
Right, which sounds completely counterintuitive at first.
Totally. I mean, it has nothing to do with your bandwidth, the software you're running, or like how many hours you spent studying the user manual.
Exactly. And that number, that 35%, it comes directly from the rigorous, mathematically validated research we are exploring today.
And the implication is just staggering. So I want to set the scene. Picture this scenario, because I know you listening to this right now have absolutely been here.
Well, we all have.
Right. So you're leading a crucial remote meeting. You're presenting this pitch you've spent, I don't know, months developing. Or maybe you're guiding a team through some complex digital workflow.
High stakes, basically.
High stakes. You're mid-sentence, the momentum is perfect, you are entirely in the flow state, and then boom, the screen completely freezes.
Yeah, or the audio glitches into that awful robotic stutter.
Exactly. The Wi-Fi drops, or the presentation software abruptly force quits to, install an update.
It's the absolute instantaneous destruction
Yeah.
of your digital environment.
Yes. And in that exact fraction of a second, a profound biological shift happens inside you. Your heart rate violently spikes. Cortisol just floods your system.
The muscles in your jaw tighten up.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Because traditionally, when we analyze this highly relatable, universally stressful moment, we immediately focus on the external stuff.
We blame the router.
Right. We blame the router. We critique the platform's user interface. We, scramble to click the right sequence of buttons to restore the
We
connection.
try to fix the tech.
Exactly. But the data we are diving into today flips that entirely. It suggests that our relentless focus on troubleshooting the hardware is completely blinding us to the actual crisis.
Which is how we are troubleshooting our internal emotional state.
Exactly. So today, our mission for this deep dive is to explore a fascinating, comprehensive, mixed methods academic study. It's titled Emotion Regulation Strategies Among ELT Teachers in Technology-Rich Classrooms.
And just to clarify, ELT stands for English Language Teaching.
Right. So the researchers look specifically at these ELT professionals to see exactly what happens inside their minds when the technology inevitably fails in front of a live, expectant audience.
And, while the study uses the ELT classroom as this sort of high-pressure laboratory, the psychological mechanisms they uncovered here are completely universal.
Because it's just human biology, right?
Exactly. We're looking at human nervous systems colliding with digital infrastructure. And the evidence we're going to walk through today demonstrates that the widespread, culturally ingrained instinct to simply, well, keep a brave face when digital tools collapse.
Which is what we're all taught to do.
Right. That instinct is actually mathematically proven to degrade your cognitive function.
That is wild. So whether you are an educator, a corporate executive, or, I don't know, a freelancer navigating client calls, this deep dive is going to fundamentally alter how you view digital competence.
It really is.
So to understand why emotional regulation is sort of the hidden architecture of professional success, we first have to understand the specific environment the study examines.
Right, the modern digital landscape.
Yeah,
Yeah.
because the literature establishes that this mass migration to digitally mediated environments, interactive whiteboards, learning management systems, Zoom calls, it didn't just change the logistics of our work.
No, not at all. It created an entirely new, highly volatile psychological landscape. And it's anchored by a phenomenon that researchers actually classify as technostress.
Technostress. Let's dig into that because it sounds like a buzzword, but it's an actual clinical concept, right?
It is. It's categorized in the academic literature as a modern adaptation disorder. So it's a specific psychophysiological condition that manifests when human beings basically can't manage or cope with the relentless demands of new computer technologies in a healthy way.
So it's not just like casual annoyance when your computer is slow.
No, it's a chronic state of sympathetic nervous system arousal. Your body is basically constantly in fight or flight. And the literature breaks this phenomenon down into four compounding dimensions that operate simultaneously.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first is techno overload. This refers to the sheer volume and velocity of digital tasks we're expected to process all at once.
Oh, sure. Like in a digital meeting, you aren't just speaking. You are monitoring the chat thread. You're checking the participant list to see who raised their hand.
Verifying your screen share borders so you aren't showing your private emails, watching the clock.
Great. It's this continuous partial attention demanded by the interface. It's exhausting.
It really is. And that leads to the second dimension, which is techno complexity. This deals with the inherent friction of the tools themselves.
Like when you feel like you just can't figure the software out?
Exactly. It's that persistent, gnawing perception that your functional skills are continually inadequate, mostly because the platforms are endlessly layered and, let's be honest, notoriously unintuitive.
Right, which seamlessly feeds into the third dimension, techno-uncertainty. Because the digital ground is quite literally always shifting beneath us.
Software platforms use agile development cycles now, which basically means updates are pushed constantly.
Oh, I hate that. You might master the specific layout of an interface on a Tuesday, and then by Thursday morning, the developer has fundamentally altered the dashboard.
They've moved the crucial buttons, they've changed the functionality.
And just lost again.
Right. And the human brain craves environmental predictability to feel safe. Modern software design explicitly denies us that predictability.
Wow, yeah. And then there's the fourth dimension, which is techno-invasion.
Right, the complete dissolution of boundaries.
Yeah, the blurring between personal sanctuary and professional obligation, driven by the fact that the technology just renders us perpetually accessible, you know, emails on your phone at 11 p.m.
Exactly. So we have these four dimensions of technostress.
Mm.
Overload, complexity, uncertainty, and evasion.
And those are universally exhausting for anyone. But the researchers chose to drop this framework into a very specific, highly pressurized context, which is English language teaching.
Yes. And ELT educators operate under what the study identifies as a dual responsibility.
Okay, break that down for us. What is dual responsibility?
Well, in a standard analog classroom, the educator's primary cognitive load is dedicated to delivering content. But an ELT teacher in a digitally rich environment is required to function as a flawless, real-time linguistic model.
Meaning they have to navigate complex syntax, subtle pragmatics, perfect pronunciation.
All while concurrently acting as the frontline IT systems administrator for 20 diverse users.
Which is insane when you think about it. The cognitive load is just staggering when you add the neurological demands of second language acquisition to the mix.
It is. ELT classrooms are intercultural hubs. Both the instructor and the learners are navigating high levels of language performance anxiety.
There's intense communicative pressure.
Plus, you are managing a room full of varying cultural scripts regarding authority, error tolerance, and emotional display rules.
So it's kind of like, let me think of an analogy. It's like trying to perform a highly complex, nuanced symphony while simultaneously having to repair the instruments as they break in your hands.
That's a great way to put it.
Like, if you are playing the violin and the bridge snaps, which is our tech failure in this metaphor, your musical performance, the actual linguistic modeling, is instantly compromised.
Right, because your prefrontal cortex has to abandon the music to deal with the broken wood and snapped strings. You physically cannot focus on both.
Exactly. You can't simultaneously optimize both. When the technology fails, the cognitive conflict is immediate and severe. But let me play devil's advocate for a moment here, because I know some listeners might be viewing this through like a historical lens.
Okay, go for it.
Well, teachers and professionals have always relied on tools, right? And those tools have always broken.
Sure.
So is technostress actually a novel psychological adaptation disorder? Or is a Zoom crash just the modern equivalent of an overhead projector bulb burning out back in 1995?
It's a really fair question.
Mm-hmm.
But the source text deliberately draws a hard line between those two paradigms.
How so?
The difference is not just a matter of degree. It is a fundamental difference in kind, and it's rooted in immediacy, visibility, and existential reliance.
Existential reliance.
Think about it.
Yeah.
When an analog tool, like an overhead projector, failed in 1995, a supplementary visual aid was lost.
Right. You couldn't see the transparency sheet.
Exactly. But the physical architecture of the classroom remained entirely intact. The educator and the learners still shared a localized physical reality.
The teacher could just turn to the chalkboard or, you know, just start talking to the class.
Right. The room still existed.
The environment didn't just evaporate.
Precisely. In a digitally mediated remote or hybrid environment, the software is the room.
Oh, wow.
The platform is the literal container of the professional reality. If the learning management system crashes or the video conferencing link severs, the environment itself ceases to exist.
The connection is completely obliterated.
Yes. And furthermore, you have the hypervisibility of online communication. Every participant's face is broadcast in a high-definition grid, staring directly forward.
Right, which amplifies the social evaluative threat. You feel like everyone is scrutinizing you.
Because there is nowhere to diffuse the attention.
Mm.
So the immediacy of the systemic collapse, combined with the total dependency on the digital infrastructure, it triggers a visceral existential threat response in your nervous system.
A response that a broken projector bulb simply did not have the capacity to induce.
Exactly.
That distinction completely reframes the stakes here. We aren't talking about losing a visual aid. We are talking about the sudden, highly public dissolution of the entire workspace.
Right. It's a much bigger deal to your brain.
So if the stakes are existentially higher, the inquiry naturally shifts to human psychology. Like, how do human beings biologically and cognitively cope with this specific pressure cooker?
And to map this out, the researchers anchored their study in two foundational pillars of psychology.
Let's get into those.
The first is James Gross's process model of emotion regulation. And the second is Albert Bandura's social cognitive theory.
Okay, let's look at Gross first.
So James Gross's work, which was heavily refined between 1998 and 2015, it fundamentally structured how we understand the life cycle of human emotion.
Because before this kind of cognitive processing model, wasn't emotion often viewed as something that just sort of happened to us, like a wave washing over the brain?
Exactly. People thought it was largely uncontrollable. But Gross modeled emotion regulation as a highly specific sequence of internal interventions.
Like steps in a process.
Yes. And while his full model contains five stages, this study zeroes in on two primary, diametrically opposed strategies.
Two totally different ways of handling the stress.
All right, there's first is an antecedent-focused strategy called cognitive reappraisal.
Antecedent meaning it targets the emotion before it fully cascades through the nervous system, right?
Exactly. It happens early in the emotion-generative process.
Uh-huh.
Cognitive reappraisal involves a deliberate, conscious, cognitive shift.
Meaning you change how you think about it.
Right. You change the way you interpret a potentially emotion-eliciting situation in order to alter its emotional impact. You're changing the narrative meaning of the event.
So in the context of a digital failure, instead of interpreting a frozen screen as a catastrophic professional failure or a loss of authority or some huge personal embarrassment,
the individual cognitively reframes it as a routine, predictable, and ultimately meaningless mechanical error.
It's just a glitch. It doesn't mean I'm a bad teacher.
Exactly. And by altering the cognitive appraisal of the event, you prevent the amygdala from signaling a threat.
So you short-circuit the severe physiological stress response before it even begins. Mm-hmm. You basically rewrite the code of the situation before the emotional software compiles it.
That's a perfect metaphor.
So that's cognitive reappraisal. What's the opposing strategy in Gross's model?
The alternative is a response-focused strategy known as expressive suppression.
Response-focused, meaning it happens later.
Right. This occurs late in the emotion-generative process, after the physiological and emotional response has already been triggered.
So the person has already perceived the frozen screen as a threat.
Yes. Their heart rate spikes, the cortisol releases, they feel that internal surge of panic or frustration, but they consciously and effortfully inhibit all outward behavioral expressions of that emotion.
They bottle it up.
Exactly. They force their facial muscles to remain neutral. They artificially modulate their vocal tone. And they basically attempt to project an aura of total calm.
Okay, think of expressive suppression, like a pressure valve on a massive industrial steam engine where someone has intentionally smashed the gauge glass.
Well, I like this analogy.
Right. So the conductor doesn't want to look at the rising pressure, so they just break the gauge and paint over it. From the outside, walking past the engine, it looks completely fine. There are no alarms ringing.
But inside the boiler.
Inside the boiler, the steam is still expanding, the physical pressure is still compounding, and the structural integrity of the metal is actively degrading. The energy hasn't been diffused at all. It has just been trapped.
And taking that steam engine analogy further, Gross's extensive empirical research demonstrates that the internal structural degradation you just mentioned is highly measurable in humans.
Wait, really? You can measure the damage of suppressing emotion?
Absolutely. Individuals who habitually rely on expressive suppression experience significant increases in sympathetic nervous system arousal.
Their fight or flight stays activated.
Yes. And their allostatic load, which is the wear and tear on the body from chronic stress, it skyrockets. They also suffer poorer memory recall of the events occurring while they are suppressing.
Because their brain is too busy hiding the emotion.
Exactly. The active effort of inhibiting behavioral expression consumes massive amounts of cognitive bandwidth. Conversely, Cognitive reappraisers navigate the exact same stressor without that biological wear and tear.
That is fascinating. And this perfectly bridges into the second theoretical framework the researchers used, right? Albert Bandura's concept of self-efficacy from his 1997 social cognitive theory.
Yes, it bridges perfectly.
So how does self-efficacy integrate with the biological realities of Gross's emotion regulation?
Well, Bandura basically revolutionized how we view human motivation and behavior by defining self-efficacy.
Which is what, exactly?
It's an individual's deep-seated belief in their own capability to organize and execute the courses of action required to manage prospective situations.
So it's not actual skill, it's your belief in your skill.
Right. In the specific context of this study, we are analyzing instructional confidence, the educator's belief in their ability to successfully deploy technology to achieve pedagogical goals, regardless of the hurdles.
And Bandura posited that this critical self-efficacy is constructed from four primary sources, right?
Correct. The first is enactive mastery experiences, which are your past successes. The second is vicarious experiences, so observing your peers succeed.
Third is verbal persuasion, like external encouragement from a mentor.
And the fourth, which is critical here, is physiological and affective states.
The physiological and affective states are the linchpin of this whole thing, aren't they?
They are the direct mechanism linking the two theories together. Your brain constantly reads the physiological data of your own body to determine your level of confidence in any given moment.
Oh, wow. So it's a feedback loop.
Exactly. If a teacher utilizes expressive suppression when the technology crashes, their heart rate is elevated, their breathing is shallow, their muscles are tense.
They feel panicked, even if they aren't showing it.
Right. And Bandura's model dictates that the brain interprets this negative, high arousal physiological state as definitive proof of incompetence.
Because the body is signaling a threat.
Yes. The body says threat. So the brain concludes, I do not have the skills to handle this. Therefore, instructional confidence plummets.
But if the teacher utilizes cognitive reappraisal instead,
then their physiological state remains regulated and calm.
Because they reframed it as just a glitch.
Right. And the brain reads that calm state, interprets it as mastery, and reinforces the belief, I am fully capable of handling this.
Wow. Okay, wait, I need to look at the cultural variables here, though. You mentioned earlier that ELT classrooms involve varying cultural scripts regarding emotional display.
Yes, culture plays a big role in behavior.
Right. So the study must address whether expressive suppression is universally damaging. Like, if we are looking at collectivist cultures where suppressing negative emotion to maintain group harmony is highly normative, it's socially expected, right? Doesn't that mitigate the damage?
The source material addresses this nuance directly, actually. It is true that the social and relational costs of suppression can be lower in collectivist cultures.
Because the behavior aligns with expected cultural scripts.
Exactly. The students might actually expect the teacher to mask their frustration to preserve the dignity of the classroom.
Right, maintaining face.
However, the cognitive and physiological costs remain stubbornly high regardless of cultural background.
So your body still pays the tax.
Yes. In the high-stakes environment of troubleshooting a live software failure, the mental effort required to suppress emotion still aggressively taxes the working memory.
Even if it is culturally appropriate to paint over the gauge on the steam engine, the physical pressure inside the boiler still restricts the machine's overall functionality.
That is exactly it. Biological tax is completely unavoidable.
Okay, so these invisible internal mechanisms, the cognitive reappraisal, the physiological feedback loops, they are incredibly complex.
Highly complex.
So how do researchers accurately capture and measure processes that happen entirely inside someone's head in like a fraction of a second?
It's notoriously difficult.
I mean, the methodology required to prove this has to be incredibly rigorous to get past subjective bias, right? We all think we're calmer than we actually are.
We do. And capturing the reality of human affective processing requires circumventing the flaws of human memory.
How did they do that?
To achieve this, the researchers deployed a highly sophisticated sequential explanatory mixed methods design.
That is a mouthful. What does that mean in practice?
It's an epistemological approach that basically utilizes a broad quantitative phase first to establish the statistical reality of the landscape.
Getting the hard numbers.
Right. And then that is followed by a deep qualitative phase to map the behavioral topography of that reality.
So starting with the broad landscape, the quantitative phase, let's look at that.
Okay, so the researchers recruited a specialized cohort of 70 in-service English language teaching professionals.
And these had to be people actually using the tech, right?
Yes, these were educators deeply entrenched in the digital reality. They were mandated by their institutions to utilize platforms like learning management systems and real-time video conferencing for a minimum of 2 hours per week.
So they are familiar with the pain of the platforms?
Intimately familiar. So to establish the baseline data, these 70 participants completed two heavily validated psychometric instruments.
The first one was the Emotion Regulation Questionnaire, ERQ, right? Developed by James Gross.
Yes, exactly.
And the ERQ uses a standard Likert scale to measure trait-level tendencies, correct? Like on a scale from 1 to 7.
Yes, a 7-point Likert scale.
Yeah.
And it specifically separates the two strategies we've been talking about.
How do they measure reappraisal versus suppression?
To measure cognitive reappraisal, participants rate their agreement with statements such as, when I want to feel less negative emotion, I change what I'm thinking about.
Okay, straightforward.
And to measure expressive suppression, they respond to prompts like, I keep my emotions to myself, or when I'm feeling negative emotions, I make sure not to express them.
Got it. And what was the second instrument they used?
The second was the Instructional Technology Confidence Scale, the ITCS.
What does that measure?
It basically forces the educator to rate their perceived self-efficacy in executing digital pedagogy.
Like, how confident are you that you can actually teach with this tech?
Exactly. With prompts like, I feel confident troubleshooting technical issues during a live lesson.
Okay, so this quantitative phase yields a massive data set correlating an individual's preferred emotional regulation style with their professional confidence.
Right. It gives us the baseline statistical relationship.
But as we mentioned earlier, self-reported surveys regarding human emotion are notoriously vulnerable. We view our own emotional maturity through a highly distorted lens.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Retrospective self-reporting is undeniably flawed. And the source material highlights these vulnerabilities.
Like recall bias.
Yes, recall bias, where your memory of an emotional event is altered by whatever your current emotional state is.
And social desirability bias, too.
Right, where professionals unconsciously inflate their scores to align with the perception of what a good educator should act
like. Nobody wants to admit they panic and scream at their computer.
Exactly. And beyond that, there is just a fundamental lack of insight. People are frequently blind to their own autonomic self-regulatory actions in moments of acute stress.
So you may genuinely believe you are calmly reappraising a situation,
while your micro-expressions and vocal prosody absolutely scream suppression.
Right. So to pierce through that subjective distortion, the study moves to the qualitative phase. And they didn't just observe all 70 teachers, did they?
No. That would be impossible. They isolated a specific subsample.
How did it pick them?
They utilized maximum variation sampling to purposefully select 15 educators from the original pool.
So they weren't just picked at random.
Not at all. They deliberately targeted the statistical outliers. They wanted the individuals who scored exceptionally high or remarkably low on reappraisal and suppression.
And did they mix up the types of teachers?
Yes, ensuring a diverse representation across public universities and private language institutes.
So this was a targeted selection designed to view the extreme edges of the data in a real-world setting. So what does the actual observation of these 15 educators look like?
The researchers engaged in extensive naturalistic observation. Each of the 15 educators was subjected to between 4.5 to 6 hours of live classroom observation during technology-dependent lessons.
That is a lot of observation time.
It is. And the observers were not looking at pedagogical content at all.
They didn't care about the grammar lesson.
Not even slightly.
Yeah.
They utilized a strict observational protocol focused entirely on nonverbal and paralinguistic markers of emotional regulation.
Like what? What were they looking for?
They documented transient facial muscle tension, the deployment of artificial or asymmetrical smiles, postural shifts from relaxed to rigid.
And vocal changes.
Yes, specific alterations in speech patterns, like clipped prosody or sudden changes in pitch that occurred concurrently with technical glitches.
Wow. And then what? Did they confront them after class?
Yes. Crucially, within a maximum of 7 days post-observation, the researchers conducted stimulated recall interviews via Zoom.
Stimulated recall, meaning they showed them the tape?
Basically. They presented the educators with the specific timestamps of the observed tech failures and asked them to retroactively unpack their internal cognitive state during those exact seconds.
Okay, wait. If a team of academic researchers is sitting in the back of your classroom or silently lingering in the participant list of your Zoom meeting,
yeah,
and they are explicitly taking notes on your facial tension and your posture, Doesn't the sheer presence of the observer inherently alter the emotional reality of the subject?
It's a classic problem.
Right. The observer effect fundamentally changes the behavior being observed.
Yes, the Hawthorne effect.
Yeah.
And the researchers openly acknowledge this as a structural limitation of all observational psychological research.
So how do they defend the data?
To mitigate this distortion, they relied heavily on methodological triangulation.
Triangulation, combining different data points.
Exactly. By synthesizing three entirely distinct data streams, the baseline psychometric survey data, the objective life behavioral observation, and the subjective cognitive explanation from the stimulated recall, they cross-referenced the findings.
Okay, I see.
So if a teacher's survey claimed they were a calm reappraiser, but the live observation recorded severe muscular tension and clipped speech during a glitch.
And the interview revealed they were actually internally panicked but trying to hide it.
The triangulation exposes the truth behind the survey bias. This robust cross-referencing generates a highly trustworthy, verified picture of reality.
Okay, with the methodology established as basically bulletproof, let's look at the actual numbers.
Let's do it.
When they processed the psychometric data from those 70 educators, what was the statistical reality?
Well, the descriptive statistics provided an initial baseline that actually seemed pretty optimistic.
Yeah, how so?
On the 7-point Likert scale, the mean score for cognitive reappraisal was 5.12, while the mean score for expressive suppression was notably lower at 3.45.
Oh, okay. So generally, the educators indicated a preference for cognitive reframing over emotional bottling.
On the surface, yes.
But the true value of the data lies in the multiple regression analysis. That is where we see how these emotional strategies actively dictate confidence.
And the regression analysis yielded unequivocal results. Cognitive reappraisal emerged as a powerful positive predictor of instructional confidence.
What were the actual numbers on that?
It boasted a beta value of 0.42 and a p-value of less than 0.001.
Okay, so for the listeners, with a beta of 0.42 and a p-value under 0.001, we aren't just looking at a minor interesting correlation here. We're looking at a statistically undeniable reality.
Totally undeniable.
The data actively confirms that as an individual's capacity to proactively reframe a situation increases, their professional confidence in a digital environment scales aggressively upward right alongside it.
It's a direct, powerful link. But conversely, expressive suppression proved to be a strong negative predictor.
Returning a beta of what?
A beta of minus 0.31 and a p-value of 0.002.
Wow. So the math literally dictates that the more an educator relies on concealing their internal emotional distress, the more severely their instructional confidence deteriorates.
Yes. The more you hide it, the worse you perform. And honestly, the most vital statistic in the entire quantitative phase is the variance.
The R-squared value.
Yes. The researchers calculated that this specific regression model, analyzing nothing but these two emotion regulation strategies, accounted for 35.4% of the total variance in instructional technology confidence.
35.4%. To see an R-squared value that high in the behavioral sciences is extraordinary.
It really is.
It mathematically proves the premise we opened with today. Over a third of a professional's confidence with digital tools has zero correlation to the actual technology.
Zero.
Over a third of their efficacy is dictated entirely by their internal emotional architecture.
The null hypotheses were utterly dismantled.
And the instruments themselves were robust.
Very. The Trombach's alpha scores for the ERQ sat at 0.81 and 0.75, yeah. And the ITCS was at a highly reliable 0.89. The quantitative evidence is securely locked.
But numbers, no matter how statistically significant, are abstract.
True.
So to understand how a negative beta of 0.31 actually destroys a lesson in real life, we have to transition to the qualitative findings.
Right, the observations.
Yeah. When the researchers analyzed the live observations, what did an expressive suppression collapse look like in real time?
Well, the qualitative thematic analysis yielded three primary themes. Let's begin with the destructive side of the spectrum, which was captured in theme two.
What's it called?
Suppression and its emotional and pedagogical cost.
Okay, unpack that for us.
The physical manifestations observed in the high suppression cohort were textbook indicators of sympathetic arousal.
So high stress.
High stress.
Yeah.
When a digital tool failed, observers noted sudden, sharp alterations in vocal prosody. Speech became noticeably clipped and rushed.
Like they just wanted to get it over with.
Exactly. There was a pronounced avoidance of eye contact with the webcam as the educators unconsciously attempted to break the social evaluative gaze of the learners.
They couldn't look the students in the digital eye.
Right. And somatic markers of stress, primarily stiffness in the cervical spine and shoulders, became highly visible.
So they were burning massive amounts of energy just trying to project an illusion of calm while their biology was betraying them in high definition.
That's exactly what was happening. And the stimulated recall interviews revealed the catastrophic cognitive cost of maintaining that illusion.
Do we have quotes from the interviews?
We do. Let's look at the specific testimony of participant 58, who was unpacking a moment where an interactive activity completely derailed.
What did they say?
They stated, "I have to just bottle it up and smile because the students can't see me panic. But inside, I'm scrambling, and I can't think clearly about how to fix the problem or adapt the activity."
I can't think clearly. That right there is the mechanism of failure.
It's the crux of the issue.
If we look at human working memory like RAM in a computer, the brain only has a finite amount of active processing power available at any given millisecond.
Right. Bandwidth is limited.
So to troubleshoot the broken software, analyze the pedagogical objective, and invent an alternative offline activity on the fly, that requires nearly 100% of that RAM. But participant 58 is dedicating a massive portion of their neurological processing power to the intense, active labor of suppressing their amygdala response and micromanaging their facial muscles.
Yes. This phenomenon, which we can categorize as cognitive diversion, literally starves the prefrontal cortex of the resources it needs to solve the actual problem.
Cognitive diversion. So the brain is just distracted by hiding the fear.
Exactly. And because the prefrontal cortex is starved of resources, the educator loses their cognitive flexibility.
What happens when they lose that flexibility?
The researchers observed that this physiological bottleneck consistently resulted in what they termed rigid adherence to derailed lesson plans.
Rigid adherence. Explain the behavioral reality of that. What does that actually look like?
Instead of recognizing the failure, abandoning the broken tool, and fluidly transitioning to a secondary strategy, the cognitively overloaded educator develops severe tunnel vision.
They just keep trying the same broken thing.
They stubbornly, almost irrationally, attempt to force the broken digital activity to function.
Yeah.
They will spend 5, 8, 10 agonizing minutes repeatedly clipping a frozen icon, refreshing a dead page, or repeating the same failed instruction.
Oh, that is so painful to watch.
It is. They are entirely paralyzed by their inability to cognitively pivot.
Wow.
And this triggers a destructive feedback loop. The persistent technological failure amplifies the internal panic. The amplified panic requires even more cognitive effort to suppress.
And the increased suppression further diminishes problem-solving capacity.
Exactly. And the instructional delivery completely disintegrates.
Yep.
Students disengage, the silence becomes palpable, and the educator's self-efficacy, their Bandura-defined instructional confidence, is decimated.
You know, there is a massive ingrained cultural contradiction at the heart of all this.
What do you mean?
Well, across corporate environments, academic institutions, and just general professional development, we are fundamentally conditioned to believe that professionalism equates to stoicism.
Oh, definitely.
Right. The ultimate marker of a seasoned leader is the ability to never let them see you sweat. We idolize the concept of the swan gliding effortlessly on the surface while paddling frantically beneath the water.
It's the gold standard of corporate behavior.
But this data violently upends that narrative. The traditional, culturally enforced definition of professionalism, which is literally just expressive suppression, actively degrades executive function.
It does. It makes you worse at your job.
If maintaining the stoic facade costs you the cognitive flexibility required to actually execute the job, then never let them see you sweat is objectively terrible advice.
It is a complete paradigm shift. In the volatile, high-velocity environment of a digitally mediated ELT classroom, prioritizing the facade over the function is a mathematical error.
A mathematical error. I love that.
By attempting to preserve an illusion of flawless authority, the educator essentially guarantees a flawed pedagogical outcome.
So if the suppression pathway leads directly to cognitive paralysis and rigid adherence, how do the statistical outliers handle it? The highly confident educators mapped in the quantitative phase.
They navigate the exact same digital infrastructure failures.
They are subjected to the exact same software crashes and bandwidth drops.
Right. They experience identical technical failures, but their internal architecture handles the event through the mechanisms detailed in Theme 1.
Which is called what?
Proactive reappraisal as confident scaffolding.
Confident scaffolding. Okay. So what is the critical distinction here?
The critical distinction is temporal. It's about timing. The most successful educators do not wait for the amygdala to fire to begin regulating.
Oh, so they do it beforehand.
Yes. Their emotion regulation is heavily antecedent focused and proactively established long before the digital environment is even launched.
So they insulate the nervous system before the threat even occurs.
Exactly. They engage in deliberate pre-framing. They cognitively restructure their relationship with the technology.
What does that sound like internally?
They view software glitches not as personal indictments, professional failures, or threats to their pedagogical authority. Instead, they view them as mundane, inevitable, and entirely routine logistical variables.
Let's look at the concrete evidence of this from the interviews. Participant 22, right?
Yes, Participant 22 demonstrated exceptionally high confidence and reappraisal scores.
And they articulated this perfectly. The quote is, "I always tell my students and myself that if the Wi-Fi drops, it's just our signal to switch to the offline backup plan. It's not a reflection on my teaching."
That quote is an absolute masterclass in efficacy-building cognitive processing.
It really is.
Notice the deliberate decoupling of professional identity from technological stability. Participant 22 has proactively severed the link between the functioning of a third-party server and their own self-worth.
It is essentially algorithmic psychology.
How so?
Well, Participant 22 has hard-coded an if-then implementation intention right into their own prefrontal cortex. If the Wi-Fi drops, then we execute the offline backup plan.
Oh, I see.
By establishing this algorithmic response proactively, they strip all the emotional volatility right out of the event. It ceases to be a crisis that requires assessment. It becomes a simple trigger for a predetermined behavioral sequence.
That's a brilliant way to frame it. And because the event is pre-appraised as non-threatening, the physiological cascade never initiates.
Right. There is no cortisol flood. There is no rapid heart rate.
And because the sympathetic nervous system remains dormant, 100% of the educator's working memory remains available for executive function.
So they smoothly and effortlessly pivot to the secondary plan.
Exactly. And returning to Bandura's model.
Yeah.
This successful navigation of the obstacle serves as a potent and active mastery experience.
It builds their confidence even more.
Yes. The brain recognizes the successful pivot, reinforces the belief that I am capable of handling digital volatility, and actively increases the baseline level of instructional confidence.
It generates an upward, self-sustaining spiral of efficacy,
perfectly mirroring the downward spiral of the suppressors.
The structural elegance of proactive reappraisal is just undeniable. But as the researchers dove deeper into the qualitative data, they uncovered an anomaly, didn't they?
They did.
They identified a regulatory behavior that did not fit neatly into Gross's established binary of internal reappraisal versus internal suppression.
Right. They found educators who were managing the technological chaos through a highly externalized, socially deeply integrated strategy.
And this discovery is arguably the most vital contribution the paper makes to the field of effective psychology.
I would completely agree with that.
The researchers codified this behavior under theme 3, emotional transparency as a facilitative strategy.
Emotional transparency.
Yeah. So this isn't proactively reframing the emotion to eliminate it, nor is it bottling it up to hide it.
No, it is the active vocal disclosure of the emotional state.
Let's define this emergent context-specific strategy,
right?
Because it's a very specific type of disclosure, right?
Yes, the researchers defined it as the calibrated strategic disclosure of negative emotion to the learners.
Okay, calibrated and strategic.
It is the deliberate transformation of a private, frustrating technological failure into a shared, collaborative, highly social moment.
Let's examine what this actually looks like in the digital classroom. Let's talk about Participant 07.
Yes. Participant 07 encountered a scenario where this screen share functionality entirely froze during a critical grammatical explanation.
A worst case scenario.
Right. And rather than suppressing the frustration to maintain a stoic facade or flawlessly pivoting to an alternate activity, Participant 07 halted the instruction entirely.
And directly addressed the digital room.
Yes. They said, well, this is annoying. Let's see if we can fix it together.
And the observation data immediately following that disclosure is profound.
It's remarkable. The researchers noted a palpable relaxation in the effective atmosphere of the digital room.
Yeah.
The tension just dissipated.
And incredibly, following the disclosure, a student actively unmuted their microphone and provided the specific technical solution required to restore the screen share.
Right. This behavior radically expands the theoretical framework we've been talking about.
Mm. Because it utilizes the controlled expression of negative emotion, not as a failure of regulation, but as a highly functional tool.
A tool for interpersonal relationship building and problem solving.
Right. It is a deeply sophisticated social regulation strategy, and it is uniquely devastating to the traditional power dynamics of the English language teaching environment.
Devastating in a good way.
Yes, because in a standard language classroom, there is an inherent, often rigid hierarchy. The educator operates as the flawless, omniscient linguistic deity.
And the learners occupy a highly vulnerable position, constantly risking error and embarrassment when they speak.
But when the educator deploys emotional transparency regarding a technical failure, it instantly dismantles that flawless deity dynamic. It fiercely humanizes the instructor.
It really does.
If we look at this through the lens of Stephen Krashen's foundational linguistic theory, specifically the effective filter hypothesis, this makes perfect sense.
Could you explain the effective filter for the listeners?
Sure. Krashen posits that when a learner's anxiety is high, their effective filter rises. It acts as a literal neurological clock that prevents language acquisition.
Right. Stress stops learning.
Exactly. So by authentically expressing mild frustration, the educator demonstrates vulnerability. If the instructor is permitted to be flawed and momentarily frustrated by the interface, the learners subconsciously realize they are in an environment where it is safe for them to be flawed in their language production.
And the collective effective filter of the room plummets.
Precisely. And by appending the inclusive phrase, "Let's see if we can fix it together," the educator executes a brilliant pedagogical maneuver.
They transform a disruptive technical glitch into an authentic, low-stakes communicative task.
Yes. The learners are suddenly utilizing their target language, English, to collaboratively solve a real-world immediate problem with their instructor.
It ceases to be an interruption. It literally becomes the lesson itself.
However, there's an incredibly fine line here that must be drawn.
Oh, a very fine line.
If we are advocating for the externalization of negative emotion in professional settings, we have to define the boundaries. What separates the highly effective strategic emotional transparency of participant 07 from, say, an educator who simply loses their emotional equilibrium, has a complete meltdown, and dumps all of their toxic anxiety onto their students?
Right, because we've all seen that happen.
We have all witnessed professionals who externalize their panic during a tech failure, and it does not lower the effective filter. It induces deep discomfort and panic in everyone observing them.
The crucial delineator, which is emphasized heavily in the source text, is the word calibrated.
Calibrated disclosure.
Yes. Calibrated disclosure is a product of high emotional intelligence. Participant 07 did not catastrophize the event. They did not scream. They did not exhibit aggressive physical behavior.
And they did not articulate existential despair, such as, "The software is destroying my career."
No. They articulated a mild, relatable, and shared reality. This is annoying.
So the expression was intentionally moderated.
Exactly. Moderated to invite collective empathy and collaboration, not to transfer an unmanageable psychological burden onto the learners.
So it requires the educator to process the emotion internally enough to scale it down to a productive level before vocalizing it.
That's it, exactly.
It is the architectural difference between stating, "We are facing a frustrating logistical hurdle," versus screaming, "The structural integrity of this project is collapsing and we are entirely helpless."
One invites community problem solving. The other incites terror.
Perfectly said. Okay, so we now possess a comprehensive map of the psychological landscape. We understand the physiological degradation caused by expressive suppression.
We understand the biological and cognitive insulation provided by proactive reappraisal.
And we understand the deeply relational power of calibrated emotional transparency.
Right.
So the definitive question presented by the researchers in the final section of the study is one of systemic application.
How do we actually use this?
Yeah, how do we fundamentally redesign our professional training infrastructure to instill these specific emotional competencies in the educators and professionals of tomorrow?
Because these are not skills acquired by reading a software patch note.
Definitely not. They are deeply ingrained psychophysiological responses. And the study forcefully argues that our current training methodologies are woefully inadequate to develop them.
They demand a systemic paradigm shift.
Moving away from the ubiquitous skills-first technology training model.
Right, and transitioning toward a comprehensive framework they title Emotionally Intelligent Teacher Education.
Emotional intelligent pedagogy, moving beyond the mechanics of the interface and addressing the human operating system.
Exactly. And the researchers propose a four-pillar framework for integration into professional development and certification programs.
Let's walk through those pillars. What's the first one?
The first pillar is direct cognitive reappraisal training.
Okay, what does that involve?
This requires shifting away from purely theoretical psychology and utilizing concrete, highly specific ELT case studies.
Like in a workshop setting?
Yes. Educators will dissect simulated technological failures and actively practice cognitive restructuring.
So they would be trained to recognize catastrophic internal narratives and structurally rewrite them into those functional if-then implementation intentions before they ever encounter a live classroom.
Exactly. You are training the cognitive reflex so it fires automatically under pressure.
That makes total sense. And the second pillar?
The second pillar targets the biological reality of emotion, mindfulness and awareness exercises.
Right, because you cannot effectively regulate an emotion if you are entirely blind to its physiological onset.
Exactly. The goal of this pillar is to train educators in somatic awareness. They must learn to recognize the earliest micro signals of sympathetic nervous system arousal.
Like the slight change in respiratory rate or the subtle tension in the jaw.
Or the initial release of adrenaline. By identifying the biological markers early in the emotion generative process, the educator can consciously intercept the automatic, culturally conditioned reflex to utilize expressive suppression.
So they catch it before the cognitive diversion drains their working memory.
Yes, you have to feel the steam building in the boiler before you can open the correct release valve.
There's that steam engine again. Okay, what is the third pillar?
The third pillar involves the social application of these skills, modeling emotional transparency.
This requires experiential learning through role play and simulation, doesn't it?
It has to, because calibrated disclosure is such a delicate, high-stakes maneuver. Educators need a controlled environment to practice the specific linguistics of vulnerability.
So they must rehearse the tone, the phrasing, and the body language required to express mild frustration and invite collective problem framing.
Right, without crossing the threshold into unprofessional emotional dumping. They have to build the muscle memory of constructive transparency.
That is so vital. And the final pillar?
The final pillar demands structural reform at the institutional level, integrating emotion regulation into digital pedagogy.
Meaning what exactly?
The researchers argue that the effective and emotional dimensions of technology integration can no longer be relegated to an optional wellness seminar.
Or a brief addendum at the end of a syllabus.
Right. They must be codified as core, mandatory modules within all teaching certification programs and ongoing professional development curricula.
So the psychology of digital interaction must be treated with the exact same academic rigor as instructional design or linguistic theory.
Exactly.
I want to reflect on the reality of corporate and institutional technology onboarding for a second. Think about the last time your organization rolled out a new enterprise software system or forced a migration to a new platform.
Oh, it's always purely operational.
The training is exclusively mechanical. It is a dense hour of click this specific tab to access the directory, utilize this drop-down menu to format the report, memorize these keyboard shortcuts to accelerate your workflow. At no point in the history of standard organizational training has an IT professional or an HR director pause the presentation to say, and here is a deeply researched cognitive reframing technique to deploy when the central server inevitably crashes and deletes an hour of your labor.
That never happened.
Or here is a somatic breathing protocol to prevent your amygdala from hijacking your prefrontal cortex when the client presentation software freezes.
It sounds absurd because we never do it, but it's exactly what we need.
This study exposes a massive blind spot in our modern organizational design. Our entire approach to integrating technology in the workplace is fundamentally broken because it aggressively ignores the neurological reality of the human being operating the machine.
That is the ultimate systemic implication of the data. Policymakers, curriculum architects, and corporate leadership must radically and urgently redefine the parameters of digital literacy.
Because in the modern era, true digital literacy cannot be constrained to mere operational fluency with a graphical user interface.
No. Comprehensive digital literacy must fundamentally encompass the psychological resilience, the somatic awareness, and the complex emotional self-regulatory competencies required to maintain executive function when that user interface inevitably fails.
And the consequences of ignoring this paradigm shift are severe. It is not merely an issue of optimizing workflow or preventing momentary awkwardness in a Zoom room.
Not at all. The stakes are quite literally existential for the educational infrastructure.
How so?
The source material explicitly links unmanaged technostratus, driven by the chronic, biologically exhausting reliance on expressive suppression, to the accelerating crisis of teacher burnout and professional attrition.
People are just quitting.
They are. Highly skilled, deeply passionate educators are actively abandoning the profession because the compounded psychophysiological toll of navigating volatile digital environments without adequate emotional regulation tools is simply unsustainable. No, it is a critical, urgent protective mechanism necessary to stabilize the human capital of the entire educational system.
It preserves the neurological health of the educator, which directly preserves the pedagogical quality for the learner.
Exactly.
The depth of insight in this study is just phenomenal. So, to synthesize the immense practical value of what the data has proven today, whether you are an ELT professional managing the complex cultural dynamics of a remote language classroom, a corporate project manager attempting to maintain alignment across distributed digital teams, or simply an individual trying to execute your responsibilities in an increasingly screen-mediated world, the mathematics of your success are clear.
Extremely clear.
Your ultimate professional competence is not defined by the bandwidth, the processing power, or the operational perfection of the digital tools at your disposal.
No. Your competence is defined entirely by how effectively you regulate your own internal psychophysiological architecture when those tools inevitably collapse.
The true secret to technological mastery is not a superior understanding of the hardware. It is a superior command of your own emotional regulation.
That is the precise, undeniable synthesis of the data. The technological infrastructure will always retain a degree of volatility. The human cognitive and emotional response is the singular variable within our absolute control.
As we conclude this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final, highly provocative angle to consider a dimension of this dynamic that extends far beyond the immediate survival of a single meeting or a single lesson.
I'm intrigued.
We have dedicated our analysis today to understanding how an educator's mastery of emotion regulation preserves their cognitive bandwidth, sustains their instructional confidence, and fundamentally shields them from the biological ravages of burnout.
Right.
But consider the silent observers in this dynamic. Think about the 20 students watching the educator intensely through the grid of webcams.
The learners themselves.
Yes. We are accelerating into a societal future where artificial intelligence, algorithmic interfaces, and deeply integrated digital infrastructure will become exponentially more complex, infinitely more invasive, and by the sheer nature of their complexity, more prone to unpredictable, disruptive, and bizarre systemic glitches.
That's definitely the trajectory we're on.
So when an educator stands at the digital intersection of a classroom, experiences a catastrophic failure of the software, and visibly, calmly executes proactive cognitive reappraisal or gracefully models calibrated emotional transparency, the most significant pedagogical act occurring in that moment has nothing to do with the English language.
Wow.
By publicly and authentically demonstrating how to maintain cognitive flexibility and emotional equilibrium in the face of sudden digital chaos, they are inadvertently instructing your students in the exact psychophysiological survival skills the next generation will require to navigate the future.
That is a profound thought.
Emotion regulation is not merely a localized strategy to survive a glitchy Tuesday morning class. It is the most vital hidden curriculum of the 21st century.
The hidden curriculum. Absolutely.
So the next time you are mid-sentence presenting your most critical idea and the screen violently freezes, the audio drops, and the digital environment collapses around you, remember the hidden curriculum.
Recognize the biological spike.
Yes. Consciously release the tension in your jaw, drop the exhaustive facade of the fake smile, and proactively reappraise the moment. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the architecture of the mind, and we encourage you to carry this profound new perspective into your next inevitable collision with digital failure.